The headlines: Israeli forces storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque for a fifth day in a row after warplanes bombed several positions of Palestinian resistance groups across the besieged Gaza Strip. Russia says it has captured Ukraine's key port city of Mariupol, the biggest city seized since the war began 8 weeks ago. U.S. police face a backlash after a viral video shows officers detaining a crying 8-year-old black boy. Hello and welcome, everybody. Tensions across the occupied territories are getting worse by the hour, with Israeli forces stepping up their atrocities against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. At least 20 Palestinians have been wounded by rubber bullets inside the mosque compound that is besieged by Israeli forces. The victims sustain injuries in the head and the neck. Regime troops have been intensifying their assaults on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including the worshippers who congregate at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been launching operations to counter the Israeli violence. Over the past month, nearly 24 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in a spate of retaliatory attacks and confrontations with Israeli forces. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kandil gives us the latest updates about how Israeli violence is on the rise against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Tensions have again flared at the Al-Aqsa Mosque when Israeli police officers for the fifth consecutive day raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as Palestinian Muslim worshippers gathered for the Fajr morning prayers. It's for the fifth consecutive day Israeli forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in order to force the Palestinian worshippers out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex following the prayers in order to allow Israeli settlers enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex to raid this Muslim holy site during the one of the Jewish holidays that is known as Passover, because according to these to the Israeli holiday, Israeli settlers are demanded to enter Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and tour it for the Muslims and Palestinians. Of course, it's a raid, it's a storming the Muslim holy site. At the time, it's a Muslim holy site. Palestinian Muslim worshippers are not allowed to freely move and to freely pray at this mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. At the same time, Israeli police, fully armed Israeli police and soldiers, are protecting Israeli settlers in order to desecrate this Muslim holy site.
Staying with news from Palestine, the resistance movement Hamas is warning Israel against trying to change the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Head of the movement's political bureau, Ismail Haniya, says Tel Aviv is delusional if it thinks it can change the Islamic nature of the compound by occupying it. He says the atrocities being committed in Al-Aqsa will only shorten Israel's presence and they will soon be expelled from Palestine. The Hamas leader says Palestinians will remain steadfast in their defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and that Israel's invasion of the holy site is doomed to fail. According to Haniyeh, this is just the beginning of the battle. Israeli aircraft have conducted new airstrikes on Palestinian resistance positions across the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel claims the attacks were launched in response to earlier rocket fire from Gaza. Palestinian groups say their defenses have repelled the intruding Israeli aircraft. Our correspondent Asher Shannon tells us more.
Israeli fighter jets and drones attacked training centers for Hamas's military wing, the Din Qassam brigades. The first airstrikes took place in the center of the Gaza Strip, and about an hour later, another airstrike targeted also a training center for Hamas south of Gaza City. Attacks took place as the Israeli regime claimed that Palestinian resistance groups fired a rocket from the Gaza Strip towards the Israeli regime. The Palestinian resistance groups did not sit idle while the Israeli strikes were taking place. They fired heavy caliber machine guns, towards the Israeli fighter jets, repelling them from the skies of Gaza. The Israeli regime Iron Dome missile interception system was triggered by heavy caliber bullets from Gaza, in another example of the failure of the multi-billion dollar Iron Dome system from detecting or differentiating between rockets or bullets from being fired from Gaza. In reaction to last night's Israeli airstrikes, Hamas's spokesman Hazem Qasem said that the Israeli strikes will not weaken the Palestinians, quite the opposite. It will make them more determined to fight for Al-Quds and to defend the Palestinian people.
It's day 57 of the war in Ukraine. Russia's defense ministry says its forces now control the entire strategic port city of Mariupol, except a steel plant that is under siege. President Vladimir Putin has also hailed, in his own words, a successful liberation of Mariupol. He has, however, ordered the Russian military to cancel any plans to storm the besieged plant, saying the area should only be blocked off for the time being. Putin has instructed his defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, that saving the lives of Russian soldiers and officers should be the top priority. Azovstal, the last Ukrainian stronghold in Mariupol, is a factory where hundreds of troops and civilians have been holed up for the past few days. Moscow says Ukrainian militants and foreign mercenaries are hiding there. It had given them a deadline of Wednesday to lay down their arms. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is reportedly cracking down on political opposition to quash dissent. According to news website The Gray Zone, Zelensky is overseeing a campaign of assassination, kidnapping, and torture of political opponents. It says the Ukrainian president claims to advocate democracy, but at the same time he outlaws and arrests his rivals. Based on the report, Zelensky's authoritarian approach has triggered the disappearance, torture, and even murder of an array of human rights activists, journalists, and government officials who are accused of having pro-Russia sentiments. The website describes Ukraine's security services as the enforcement arm of Zelensky's repressive orders. China's President Xi Jinping has once again taken the Western world to task for imposing sanctions on other countries in a unilateral manner.
In today's world, any unilateralism and extremist egoism are fundamentally unworkable, and any decoupling, cutting off supplies, and extreme pressure are fundamentally unworkable.
Xi called unilateral sanctions abusive and slammed double standards. The Chinese president did not directly mention the West's punitive measures against Russia, but he has repeatedly criticized anti-Moscow sanctions, including those imposed after the start of the war in Ukraine. Elsewhere in his speech, the Chinese president called for building sustainable security architectures and finding peaceful resolutions to global crises through dialogue and negotiations. He also said efforts are needed to stabilize the global supply chain, adding, however, that China's economy is resilient and not prone to change in the long term. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have economic and political analyst Einar Tangen joining us from Beijing, and from Islamabad, non-resident fellow of the Center for China and Globalization, Zamir Ahmad Awan, is with us here on News Review. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Tangen in Beijing. Let's go over the comments made by the Chinese president in his reference to sanctions. Does he mean sanctions in general, or was he trying to pinpoint the efficacy of the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia recently?
Well, he's talking about both. China suffers under sanctions, so has Europe, so it has South Korea, Japan under Donald Trump. Sanctions were handed out like Halloween candy. So at this juncture, Xi is making the point that these kind of regressive economic policies, this retreating behind a wall, is not going to have the same effects as building trade bridges.
All right. Mr. Ahmad Awan, there's been a lot of talk about trying to eradicate the Cold War mentality. What are those components that are making the situation right now resemble a Cold War era and a Cold War East-West standoff?
In fact, during the Cold War era, the sanction was used to coerce enemies as a tool of excursion. In fact, sanction was politically motivated. And still, this mentality existed. And now, in the current world, recently, the USA is imposing sanctions on different countries. And especially, the unilateral sanctions are not acceptable, are irrational and illogical, and also illegitimate. In fact, sanction was never productive. Sanction has never produced the desired results. In fact, sanctions are harmful and counterproductive. I believe that China has raised the voice of unilateral sanctions, and the rest of the world should stand with the China and support the Chinese stance that the sanction should not be used as a political tool to coerce the enemies. Sanctions should be imposed through the United Nations Security Council or with the consensus globally. Unilateral sanctions are really, really is not acceptable by any civilized manners.
All right, gentlemen, stay with us as we're going to take a look at some online reactions to the news. First reaction by Li Zhaoxi, who writes, "We're not living in a friend or foe, black or white world. The right way to solve the conflict is to promote peace talks. The old path of Cold War mentality and bloc confrontation won't work anymore, and the approach of choosing sides and dividing the world is undesirable." Ethel Red 1917 writes, "Cold War mentality is why Brits and Americans supplied shells for Ukrainians to kill Russian civilians for 8 years before Russia struck back. Did the world really think Russia would let USA put nukes on Russian border without a fight? This war is made in the USA." And our last response, more sanctions. More sanctions are clearly going for a tie. Why not go for a win against Russia? The sanctions aren't working. Let's focus on some of the reactions that we just went over. Einar Tangen, the last one about Russian sanctions. Do you think the sanctions on Russia are working?
It's creating hardship for the Russian people, but it is not going to change the politics, in my estimation. Russia's in the unique position where it has enough energy and it has enough basic foods in order to weather the current situation, not only the aftermath of COVID-19, but this issue with the sanctions against them and the non-production of Ukraine. The rest of the world is going to have a much more difficult time. So while these sanctions may appear to be hurting Russia, in actuality, they're going to hit hardest against developing countries. We've already seen in Sri Lanka, food riots, energy riots, not collapse of government, but real hardships there. And you can expect that pattern to continue. And unfortunately, people are not taking into consideration the rest of the world, which is not involved in this dispute between Russia and the U.S., and who are going to suffer because of it.
Mr. Awan, in Islamabad, do you think that regarding this whole Cold War mentality might be emerging right now, do you think we're approaching slowly a status where global powers, Western or Eastern, will be urging countries to choose sides?
In fact, President Joe Biden was in the American government in different positions since 1970s. And he was a part of the many action taken during the Cold War. He was trained, he was brought up, and he was a part of the Cold War mentality. So it is in his characteristic that he still
is in the state of the Cold War mentality. It needs to be changed. Unfortunately, he is still keeping his old mentality and practicing the same exercise in the modern world. His new actions, sanctions on the Russia and on other countries, is a proof of his Cold War mentality. And in this way, he is dragging the geopolitics backward to the Cold War era, which is not acceptable. And now, most of the countries, especially the youth of the world, they understand the Cold War was not beneficial for any side. So I think that he will not succeed. He will not maintain the same mentality for a longer time.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Zamir Ahmad Awan, non-resident fellow of the Center for China and Globalization from Islamabad, and economic and political analyst Sander Tangen joining us from Beijing. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Welcome back. The violent arrest of a young black boy for apparently stealing a pack of chips has once again sparked outrage across the U.S., bringing to the fore the issue of police brutality. The incident happened in Syracuse, New York. The viral clip has been watched millions of times on social media, with many users accusing the white officer of racism. The man filming the incident accuses the police of treating the boy like a cold-blooded criminal. Local media reported that the boy, who was later released without charge, was just 8 years old. The New York State governor described the video as, quote, heart-wrenching. The New York police said it would investigate the incident, adding that it's also reviewing body camera footage of the incident. In February, a video of police in New Jersey violently tackling a black teenager during a mall fight with a young white man sparked outrage. It prompted the state's governor to condemn what appeared to be racially disparate treatment. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Early in the pandemic, the World Health Organization stated that SARS-CoV-2 was not transmitted through the air. That mistake and the prolonged process of correcting it sowed confusion and raises questions about what will happen in the next pandemic. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Diane Lewis Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Why WHO Took 2 Years to Say COVID is Airborne. Here's the story. As 2021 drew to a close, the highly contagious Omicron variant of the pandemic virus was racing around the globe, forcing governments to take drastic actions once again. The Netherlands ordered most businesses to close on December 19th. Ireland set curfews, and many countries imposed travel bans in the hope of taming the tsunami of COVID-19 cases filling hospitals. Amid the wave of desperate news around the year-end holidays, one group of researchers hailed a development that had seemed as though it might never arrive. On December 23rd, the World Health Organization WHO uttered the one word it had previously seemed incapable of applying to the virus SARS-CoV-2, airborne. On its website, a page titled Coronavirus Disease, COVID-19, How is it Transmitted? Was quietly edited to state that a person can be infected when infectious particles that pass through the air are inhaled at short range, a process otherwise known as short-range aerosol or short-range airborne transmission. The website says that transmission can occur through long-range airborne transmission in poorly ventilated or crowded indoor settings because aerosols can remain suspended in the air or travel farther than controversial distance. It was a relief to see them finally use the word airborne and to say clearly that airborne transmission and aerosol transmission are synonyms, says aerosol chemist José Luis Jiménez at the University of Colorado Boulder. The seemingly uncontroversial statement marked a clear shift for the Switzerland-based WHO, which had tweeted categorically early in the pandemic. Fact, COVID-19 is not airborne, casting the negative in capital letters, as if to remove any doubt. At that time, the agency maintained that the virus spreads mainly through droplets produced when a person coughs, sneezes or speaks, an assumption based on decades-old infection control teachings about how respiratory viruses generally pass from one person to another. The guidance recommended distancing of more than 1 meter, within which these droplets were thought to fall to the ground, along with hand washing and surface disinfection to stop transfer of droplets to the eyes, nose and mouth. It took until October 20th, 2020, for the agency to acknowledge that aerosols, tiny specks of fluid, can transmit the virus. But the WHO said this was a concern only in specific settings, such as indoor, crowded, and inadequately ventilated spaces. Over the next 6 months, the agency gradually altered its advice to say that aerosols could carry the virus for more than a meter and remain in the air. But this latest tweak is the WHO's clearest statement yet about airborne transmission of SARS-CoV-2. And it places the virus among a select group of airborne infections, a label long reserved for just a handful of the world's most virulent pathogens, including mycelis, chickenpox, and tuberculosis. The change brings the WHO's messaging in line with what a chorus of aerosol and public health experts have been trying to get it to say since the earliest days of the outbreak. Many decry the agency's slowness in stating unambiguously that SARS-CoV-2 is airborne. Interviews conducted by Nature with dozens of specialists on disease transmission suggest that the WHO's reluctance to accept and communicate evidence for airborne transmission was based on a series of problematic assumptions about how respiratory viruses spread. For example, even in the middle of the fast-moving epidemic, the WHO dismissed field epidemiology reports as proof of airborne transmission because the evidence was not definitive, something that is difficult to achieve quickly during an outbreak. Other criticisms are that the WHO relies on a narrow band of experts, many of whom haven't studied airborne transmission, and that it eschews a precautionary approach that could have protected countless people in the early stages of the pandemic. Critics say that inaction at the agency led to national and local health agencies around the world being similarly sluggish in addressing the airborne threat. Having shifted its position incrementally over the past 2 years, the WHO also failed to adequately communicate its changing position, they say. As a result, it didn't emphasize early enough and clearly enough the importance of ventilation and indoor masking, key measures that can prevent airborne spread of the virus. Lydia Morvasa, an aerosol scientist at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, spearheaded several efforts to convince the WHO and other health agencies of the airborne threat. She says that airborne transmission was so obvious as far back as February 2020, and that omitting it from official guidelines was disastrous. Resolving this debate about how to assess the transmission of respiratory viruses matters, say researchers, because a more deadly variant of SARS-CoV-2 could emerge at any time, and new respiratory viruses will almost certainly plague humanity at some point. It's not clear whether the WHO and the world will be ready.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK court has approved the extradition of Julian Assange to the US. The UK Home Secretary will decide on this fate. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at issues related to Assange, such as the freedom of speech, the accusation itself, whether it should be called espionage, given the depth of the revelations, why it is that Assange is being punished for revealing the ones who have committed the felony or the murders, where is the justice in that? Well, first, let's get an idea from our correspondent, Rob Carter, who joins us from London to tell us more about this. Rob Carter, at this point, things just don't look too good. Anybody that perhaps is on social media or otherwise is not very optimistic about this. What would tell us more about, the steps before a final decision is going to be taken?
Yes, of course. Well, it is important to realize that this decision doesn't mean that all of the legal options for Assange's team have been exhausted. Let's make that absolutely clear. So, of course, a major blow in the years-long fight for Assange to essentially not be extradited to the US on espionage charges, that has taken a major development today. However, the decision now goes towards the British government. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, will be making that decision. But over the next 4 weeks, Assange's legal team can make appeals and submissions to the Home Secretary in order to basically plead their case to try and convince her to rule in their favour still. So the fight isn't actually over. But of course, a lot of people are deeply worried about which way the Home Secretary will rule on this, especially because she has a reputation for kicking as many people out of the UK as she possibly can, in particular refugees and so on. So obviously she has a bit of a reputation for shipping people outside of the UK. Will this case, however, be taken differently? That is the big question. And of course, there is a lot at stake here. Freedom of speech, freedoms for journalists to report on state corruption. And of course, let's remember that on the one side, the US side, they're arguing that, hey, Julian Assange, he conducted criminal activities and basically put the state secrets out there in the public, which he shouldn't have done, risking national security. But then on the other side of that argument, Julian Assange has literally done his job as a journalist, and a lot of the information that was leaked by WikiLeaks was of great public interest, especially in regards to military wrongdoing by the West in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. So a massive story here, but it's far from over, I think, and we have to be clear that the fight for Assange's freedom is still ongoing.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That is Rob Carter, correspondent from London. Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, Mick Napier, activist and commentator, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, McNapier. Looking at what has happened, a formal approval for the extradition of Julian Assange to the U.S. on espionage charges, the fate to be decided by the U.K. Home Secretary Priti Patel. What's your reaction upon hearing this?
He's a journalist. And when this material was released by WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning spent 7 years in a U.S. prison for their part in that. This was picked up by journalists in The Guardian and other prominent media around the world who made a lot of money out of what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were revealing. Circulation went up. And these journalists who were very happy to take what Julian Assange made available to them have largely turned their backs on him. I think this is a grim, grim day. Who can forget, who has ever seen it, the footage which WikiLeaks showed of a US Apache helicopter, I think it was, killing Reuters journalists and civilians in a street in Iraq. And then when later a vehicle comes to pick up the bodies, they were also shot at and killed as well. So I think what's happening is a journalist who's done a fantastic job of revealing that which our rulers would wish to remain hidden has been treated extremely cruelly. He's been tortured in Belmarsh prison in high security isolation for the last 3 years, but the man's a journalist. What he's done is what other journalists who were worth anything would dream of doing. And the fact that he's being extradited is nothing more revenge. It's revenge by the Pentagon, which our other guest might shed much more light on than I can, but it's certainly revenge by the US establishment, aided and abetted by their British counterparts, for something which they could never forgive. And that is the revelation of terrible war crimes against the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. And we have to put this in context. This intervention in Iraq was something which someone who died recently, an ex-US Secretary of State, had said on one occasion, 500,000 deaths through sanctions was a price worth paying. And that was even before the war started.
Right.
So this is a grotesque crime which Assange has revealed. And for being a wonderful journalist, he's now going to be sentenced to life in the American prison system, which is so horrific, I don't even want to think about it.
Sure. Well, Scott Bennett, I'm not too sure how to approach this with you because, it says that there's a decision that needs to be made. It's then the possible extradition to the U.S. I mean, that extradition to the U.S., it is stated that this is going to be then reviewed in a U.S. court, and then come to find out the U.S. court is actually an espionage court. So it's almost like a kangaroo court in which the verdict most likely and most definitely is going to be the guilty verdict. And maybe all of this could be just really being not staged, but some are saying that, the U.K. is going to okay this and Assange is going to get extradited to the U.S. Tell us how you really see this moving forward based on what has now occurred.
Well, I think the entire life of Western freedom and Western truth in journalism hangs in the balance with the imprisonment and death of Assange, which is most likely. So will be the imprisonment and death of all American journalists, indeed all American citizens, in fear of this tyranny police state that is cancerously morphing in the West. So Julian Assange is much bigger than his particular case. He represents and symbolizes the expected rights and freedoms and truth of the entire Western civilization, which is becoming a laughable mockery and not at all reflective of reality. As the mockery and as you wisely identified, the kangaroo court of this silly charge against Assange has absolutely no basis in law. It has no basis in truth. It is a revenge act, and it is an act of violence upon every free American, free person indeed in the world, and journalists are to be the vanguards of truth and expose government and power when it is run amok. And that is what Julian Assange did. That's indeed what one of my colleagues did, Edward Snowden, who I worked with at Booz Allen Hamilton, when he was exposing Swiss bank financing of terrorism through the Biden-Obama administration. And Ed Snowden, who worked with me at Booz Allen, left the country because he knew what was coming. Julian Assange tried to flee the persecution, and they captured him and have imprisoned him for the better part of a decade and tortured him. Your Scottish colleague is very accurate in his analysis. They have tortured Assange, and they have sought to destroy him. I do not expect any justice or honor from Priti Patel. I think that judge is indeed going to be ruthlessly savage in the destruction of truth and rights, and he will be extradited. But of course, there's always hope that the world's population will rise up and demand and challenge and perhaps overthrow these tyrannical governments in America, in Britain, as you see in elsewhere in Western civilization. So the espionage court, the espionage charges have no basis in reality. They have no legal footing. We may see Bradley Manning, who calls himself Chelsea Manning, called to testify in defense of Julian Assange, which could obliterate charges. We may even see, hopefully, any Western politicians standing up and demanding Julian Assange be pardoned, that indeed all charges be dropped. Because if you can do this to Julian Assange for speaking the truth about war crimes that the United States has engaged in from Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, the list goes on.
Right.
Then you can oppress and kill every person that speaks the truth.
Okay. We're going to review some things that I believe that needs to be reviewed, perhaps again, McNabb here. And one of them is, Scott Bennett actually mentioned there, is the charge itself, espionage, in the context of what Julian Assange did. Because of the content of what was revealed, is there justification in the accusations brought against Assange? Because we know that obviously that revealed what the U.S. government did in particular, which in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan could amount to war crimes. Do you believe that this espionage label that has been given to Assange is justified for him then to go through this judicial proceeding?
Well, look, it's not a case of looking at the dictionary, but what does espionage mean? Espionage means revealing secrets which the government doesn't want to be revealed, usually in the service of a foreign power. Julian Assange revealed secrets which the US government did not want to be revealed in the interest of US citizens and those of us around the world who were being kept in the dark about the extreme gravity of these crimes. Now, we knew about a lot of stuff. We knew that, for example, in Scotland, that prisoners were being transferred through Presbury Care for torture in various parts of the world on behalf of the British and the Americans. We knew it, but we didn't have the smoking gun. We knew that anybody who's not a fool knows that terrible crimes were being committed in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we didn't have the smoking gun. Assange provided the film footage. We saw it, and it was so graphic and so disturbing and impossible for spin merchants to spin. That's the gravity of his crime in the eyes of the Pentagon and the US elite. No, it's nothing to do with law. It's to do with revealing secrets which the state did not want to have revealed. And revenge is the entirety of the story. And I think I usually try to avoid hyperbole, but in this case, I think the situation is so grave that a brave journalist is about to be murdered, judicially murdered, using the appalling U.S. prison industrial complex, and we need to stand by him. Everybody needs to stand by him. And I think his only hope is an absolutely aroused and enraged public opinion at the moment in Britain. Now, remember, this man was detained and charged on charges of sexual assault, which were very sinister indeed, coming from Sweden, and those charges were dropped when they had served their purpose. When he was being detained in Britain, he offered to stand trial in Sweden if he was guaranteed he would not be extradited to the USA. That is, if the Swedish government would say this is a case of an alleged sexual assault and it will be dealt with as that. The Swedish government refused to give him that guarantee. And he knew that if he went to Sweden, he would be pushed onward to the USA. The British government did not ask for such a guarantee. So we had, all along, this whole thing smells of a terrible, terrible, partly conspiracy. Something's taking place in the dark, but largely in front of our eyes, where this man is right. being ground down by various governments for a very clear activity on everything. Can I just say one thing? We owe him very, very big. And because we owe him for revealing these secrets, it's our duty to come to his support.
Well, as Scott Bennett, our guest there, mentioned the phrase smoking gun, which I think exactly is what happened when we saw that video years ago. But what came of it? I mean, you have a smoking gun revealing these so-called secrets of which we know that the U.S., for example, is guilty of. And yet we're having those types of what has amounted to war crimes, as you mentioned, in countries like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, still continue. I mean, even the U.S. comes out and says, you know, this is collateral damage when it comes to the killing of civilians. So what good did the smoking gun do if those types of crimes continue and get repeated?
Well, the smoking gun of Julian Assange's revelations was really, from a military perspective, a very small, isolated incident, which I would say could have been, apologetically presented. It could have been spun by the military in a different way. Instead, that exposure set in motion a domino effect of responses and antagonisms and aggression by the U.S. military, by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the Department of Justice, by the White House, by various war crime, Zionist neocon lunatics on Capitol Hill, that all saw this as a challenge to the American empire. And never forget, the American empire, the military-industrial complex, the Zionists, the British have all been pushing for this world full-spectrum dominance against countries that stand against it, Iran, Russia, China. So Julian Assange was a flare in the sky that the U.S. responded to with all instruments of its national power. And it's fascinatingly hypocritical that President Donald Trump, who won the presidency largely because of the revelations of WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange revealing the corruption in the Clinton and the Biden Obama administrations, Donald Trump never issued a pardon, as he should have. That's shameful. And Julian Assange deserves a pardon. He deserves to be set free. He deserves nothing of what has happened to him, because he was standing up for truth for all people around the world. There is no freedom if the government grants it to you. There is only freedom when the people rise up and control the governments that they create. That was the premise of the American founding, but it is morphed into a police state after the World Trade Center attacks in 2001. That was used as a military juggernaut. It was based on complete lies and fabrications, but that was used to set in motion this military juggernaut into Afghanistan, into Iraq, into Libya, into Syria. They were planning on 7 countries in 5 years, and that's what Julian Assange stood up against by just identifying one particular incident. And the overreaction shows us just how fragile and desperate and really mentally incoherent the American empire, the American government, the American military really is. And you see that in their silly adventures in Ukraine and elsewhere. So the empire of the West is really crumbling, and Julian Assange set that in motion by not only identifying truth, but triggering the West to overreact. Every nation and every journalist around the world should be looking at the United States as a monstrous deformity of what it previously claimed to represent. It is not a light sitting on a hill. It is a black hole of darkness that sucks into it and destroys everything that stands for light, everything that stands for truth, everything that stands for human rights, everything that stands for sovereignty and the equilibrium of freedom and free nations. The United States stands against that and is the opposite of that. And it saddens me to say it, having served the United States in the military and my father before me, we are witnessing America deform into a Frankenstein cannibalistic monstrosity that is obsessed with devouring the nations of the world, subjugating them by all means necessary, including bioweapon chemical labs, as they've been developing in Ukraine, that's been revealed. But it has to exterminate truth and truth tellers. So they will, no doubt, exterminate, torture Julian Assange as a marker for the rest of the world to try and intimidate the world. Hopefully the world will rise up and throw off that intimidation, and you will see a reverse impact. So perhaps Julian Assange will be one of the greatest heroes of truth and reignite an awakening in all Western civilized peoples.
McNapier, when we started this discussion, you talked about how it's a sad day for the journalists that actually used Assange's information or release and made lots of money over it, that they are not rising up to his cause at this point. And our guest there talks about how the world needs to rise up. What can be done in order for the attention, the proper attention, be given here to maybe, for there to maybe be a chance to stop what is going to happen, especially if he does get extradited to the U.S., which the prospects look very grim, because as many are concluding, the U.S. has to make an example of Assange so that other whistleblowers don't come forward.
Well, you know, he can only go to the States, and I think when that happens, it'll be lost. But he can only leave Britain if a lot of people cooperate. Priti Patel is a monstrous figure who has been in favour of driving would-be asylum seekers back into the sea to come to Britain. She's really somebody who will try to get him to the States in every way possible. But, you know, sometimes when she's been expelling refugees and trying to get them back to some country in Africa, pilots have refused to fly them. They have refused to take off in an aircraft while people are in shackles and have been forced onto their aircraft unwillingly. There are many ways this can be stopped, but it will need a very aroused, determined, and organized public opinion. Because if Assange goes to the States, we will all be diminished. And that's the whole point of it. When somebody is taken from our ranks, when every journalist is told, this can happen to you if you ever use information of which we disapprove, then that's the problem. We will be diminished. Journalists have been massively diminished already. I mean, we talk in Britain about a free press, but it's a free press if you can get an oligarch to sponsor you. Otherwise, we're back to social media. The areas for free and open discussion in Britain, in the British press, which once were real, have been closed down over the last 20 or 30 years. Some of the giant figures would now be impossible because there's simply no space for them.
Okay.
And Assange is a litmus test. We need all good men and women have to come to the aid of Julian Assange.
Final question goes to you, Scott Bennett. What do you think the chances are going to be of Assange getting extradited to the U.S. and what will happen there, in your opinion?
I think it's 100% guaranteed he'll be extradited because the British government and judiciary are slaves and pawns and robots to the empire, the Anglo empire, the Atlanticist empire. And your guest is right. What should happen is every newspaper and journalistic entity should pull out of the United States, and you should have a massive sanctioning of the United States. No American should be welcome in any sporting event, much as they're trying to do to other nationalities, including Russian. The only way to stop this devouring of the world is to stop the devourer of the world and to sanction it and to withdraw from it and ignore it and turn away from it. And it's a sad day, but otherwise all freedoms, all people will be in danger.
Very well. Thank you so much for that. Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer from San Francisco. Nick Napier, thank you. Activist and commentator from Edinburgh. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takvayis, goodbye. Until next time.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. In the realm of truth, we have two very dear guests. Now I want them to introduce themselves to you. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum, I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK and I'm studying in the holy city of Qom, alhamdulillah.
Such a pleasure to be with you. So you're studying religion?
Yeah, I'm studying in the Hawza.
Yes.
I'm Sadiqa from the UK as well, and I'm studying in Qom as well in the Sisters Hawza. And my field of study is fiqh and usul. Fiqh and usul is basically the principles of jurisprudence.
Very great. Now, we see people, they fast, they pray, they do too much of ibadats, so, which are the things they do to get closer to God. But still, Muslim people have issues in their societies. Still, there are people who lie. Still, there are people who fight with each other. Still, there are people who do plenty of wrong things. Now, how do you justify that, sister?
We have two devils. You have the outer devil, and then we have the inner devil. The inner devil is that soul that we have not corrected within ourselves. We still have these evil traits within ourselves that we've never bothered to correct, or maybe we did not succeed in correcting them. And therefore, when the month of Ramadan comes, it's still there, because the month of Rajab and Sha'ban are there to help us correct ourselves. But if we do not take advantage of these situations, of these times, and just focus on our day-to-day lives without focusing on correcting our souls, we're never going to be able to correct ourselves or correct our communities. Because God does not change the condition of a people unless they change it themselves.
Exactly.
So that's the first point. The second point comes down to the month of Ramadan is an opportunity for us. And as we said, we have the free will, whether we use it or not. It comes down to how we use the position, the banquet that Allah has spread for us. How do we use it? Because shaitan might be locked up, but our inner devil is still there, ready to strike whenever we...
We still have free will.
We still have free will, and we also have the inner devil that we are using on our free will to, to inflict trouble on others.
We have to overcome that.
We have to overcome that, yes.
Exactly. So now, brother, you see, it's not just about the holy month. As Muslim people, we see that we have plenty of this heritage that tells us, do not do this, don't do that, and go for these good things, go for good deeds, be in hurry for doing those good deeds. What happens to a Muslim that goes outside the line? You know what I mean? We do all those good things, but that does not change a lot about us. How is it?
Comes back to what the sister said.
And the fasting turns out to be just not eating or not drinking.
Yeah, I mean, Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra has a really beautiful hadith on this. And she says, what is wrong with the person who fasts with their stomachs, but not with their eyes, with their hands, with their heart, with the other parts of themselves? When you're fasting, the hadith actually teach us, the riwayat, the narrations teach us, that fasting is not just a physical action. It is actually something which should be done with all of our essence and being.
Exactly. The entire being of ourselves has to go through this